Welcome to the Long-Term Investing Podcast with Baskin Wealth Management. I'm Barry Schwartz, President and Chief Investment Officer. In this podcast, we ignore all the noise and have conversations about the things that matter in today's markets. It's what we talk about with each other here in the office, and we want to share those conversations with you. Please stay tuned for our legal disclaimer at the end of the episode. How's it going, everybody? Thank you for joining us today on the podcast. We're going to talk today about compounders. We're going to touch a little bit about some companies that we have that have reported earnings or are in the news. Taiwan Semi, Apple. Who else, Ernest?
Netflix.
Netflix, of course. Waste Connections. Yep. We'll touch on the fact that compounders are having a rougher year this year as people are certainly looking at non-profitable, exciting names and ignoring the companies that are reporting strong earnings and good results. Nothing new for us. We'll talk about why we're sticking with what we know how to do, which is owning great businesses. Before we get into that, let's get into this. If you like this podcast, please subscribe to us on YouTube, on Apple, and on Spotify. And of course, Baskin Wealth Management, if you have any interest in our services, you want to talk to us, please check us out. Please go to our website at baskinwealth.com. Please follow me and Ernest on Twitter. You get a lot of great information and learn a little bit about how we invest and our style. And Ernest, I'm celebrating my 25th year now at Baskin. You've been here, what, 10 years?
Yep, this is my 10th year.
Exciting. So not only are we long-term investors, but we're long-term employees and long-term owners of the company. So we've been getting some questions from clients about the markets in the sense that how can it be at all-time highs? How can the TSX and the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ be at or near record highs with so much uncertainty? Every day there's a news item that somehow stuns the market. For example, today there's some worries about Trump maybe putting exports on U.S.-made goods it's to China. I mean, there's so much conversation every day about the worries about the trade, the tariffs, the uncertainty, all these things. However, what we're seeing, of course, is people need to remember that you buy stocks to participate in the growth of corporate profits, and we've seen tremendous corporate profits even in this third quarter when companies are reporting. We've seen lots of strong results. Whether or not the stock prices agree, that's a different story. But over the long term, of course, if corporate profits rise to record levels, then that's why stock prices should go up with them. The other thing, of course, we're seeing is interest rates coming down. The 10-year government bond in the U.S. is well below 4% now, the lowest it's been in quite a long time. As interest rates continue to fall, as they look for more interest rate cuts in both U.S. and Canada, that makes stock valuations all that much more attractive, right? Because putting your money in the bank as you used to get 6%, now you're getting 5%, now you're getting 4%, now you're getting 3%, that's not a livable wage, right? So there's lots of reasons to expect strong results. Obviously, we have a massive AI tailwind right now. Whether that continues is anybody's guess, but certainly we're going to get, I guess, some more color from some of our big tech companies that start reporting in Q3. We're already near the end of the year. I'm sure we're going to start to get some color as to what their guidance is for CapEx as the spending on AI continues to be growing at a fast pace. Just pretty strong across all those companies. And we're hearing and seeing companies that are saying that they're actually seeing benefits from implementing AI. And then you have these pie in the sky ideas, right? Yep. Where Amazon says they're going to replace all their workers with robots, where we're all going to be in robo-taxis. And so you can imagine that the demand for technology and AI and chips will continue at a strong pace. So I hope that sets the table for you as to what's going on with the market. Ernest, let's get into, I think before we, I'd love to talk about Apple.
Sure.
Because this was one where people were asking many months ago when Warren Buffett was trimming down his position, shouldn't we? You know, if the smartest guy in investing is trimming his position, why aren't you? And of course, that was at a time when Apple was around $200 a share. it's reached now a record high. I pulled back a little bit today, but you know, in the $250 to $260 range. And so, Ernest, can you explain and walk us through how we can hold Apple as investors when the narrative at times, you know, everybody's telling you got to get out. Buffett selling, they're not working in China. Their AI is there's nothing there. You know, their phones, they don't innovate. Like, why in the world does Apple stock recovered now to all-time highs?
So I think there's two things specific to Apple that have benefited the stock price or the market's perception of Apple over the last couple of months. The first thing is that the new iPhone, the iPhone 17, it seems that people like it, especially in China, where there's been worries that about competition from phones from Huawei or Xiaomi or some of the other local manufacturers. So it seems that consumers in China really like the new iPhone 17.
I think we saw a data point where iPhone sales were now, you know, iPhone was now the number one selling product back in China.
That's right.
After many months where Huawei and other, I guess, Asian manufacturers were taking the charge. So you know, it's really unknowable, of course, what consumers yes. will like, but clearly it's pretty knowable that Apple, with its 17 versions of iPhone, that it certainly has taken over the world. And so Apple came out with two versions of its phone, right?
So there's the regular 17, and then there's the 17 Pro.
Yeah.
And then there was a new version this time called the Air,
okay.
which is a very slim eSIM only iPhone, which I don't use iPhone myself,
yeah.
actually, but I know people who bought the Air,
mm-hmm.
and it's actually incredible how
yeah.
thin it is mm-hmm. and how it feels when you hold it.
Is the Air a dumbed down version of the iPhone Pro?
No. Mm-hmm. Well, it is certainly less powerful than the Pro version.
Okay.
It has less cameras. The specs are a little bit weaker. The battery mm-hmm. life is worse, but it serves a different market.
So why didn't the iPhone 16 resonate with the Chinese consumers and now the iPhone 17 is? Because they seem to be just a better iteration of previous phones.
Well, some of this is due to the incentives program around the pricing mm-hmm. of the iPhones, because in China, they have certain incentive programs for consumers to purchase phones below a certain price mm-hmm. threshold. Mm-hmm. And so Apple had wisely priced its iPhones in China such that they were eligible for these programs.
Yeah.
And so it's not surprising that if you cut the price, then demand goes up.
I can't remember if it was a year or two ago where there were headlines saying that Chinese government officials weren't allowed to have an iPhone. That was kind of scary, right? So kind of a way for kind of a tariff for,
yep.
You know, an import control on Apple. And, you know, you're not sure if these things are political
Yes.
or demand related, but that of course hurt iPhone. I guess Tim Cook went over to China a number of times and made nice.
Yep.
And so that is bearing fruit, pardon the pun.
Well, I think another thing is that in China specifically, the iPhone is viewed, the perception of you having an iPhone is quite different from other brands as a Western focused brand.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the way that Apple markets its products and the way that it goes to market is a little bit different than what you would see in North America, especially because, like, even the apps that are being used in China, they're different than in North America.
So what's next on the docket for Apple? We're hearing rumors that they'll have a foldable iPad, a foldable iPhone
yep.
in 2026, I guess. They refreshed the AirPods, which looks spectacular. They've refreshed the watch a bit. Are there any other hints or rumors or anything else Apple's working on? And of course, can you address the AI part of Apple, which right now is lacking?
Right. So I think they do all of those things that you mentioned are rumors, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
Like there has never been an official announcement from a press event about a foldable iPad or even a foldable phone. But Apple is a very, very well followed company. There's analysts who their only job is to track what's going on with Apple and try and predict what types of products they're working on. Mm-hmm. And so it's pretty clear that those products are being worked on and will be released sometime in the next couple of years. Mm-hmm. With regards to AI, there has been some rumors about a home device that they're working with a bit of a robotic arm that
will do for you.
I think it's up to your imagination what this product is going to do. But they are working on a lot of things within AI and even within robotics that I think people are not aware of.
Yeah. All right. So we'll have to see. I think Apple says they're going to announce a updated version of Siri sometime in 2026. Yep. Maybe it will include ChatGPT or Gemini. We're not sure, obviously. Apple obviously very coy with what it comes out with.
Well, I think the other thing with regards to Apple is that I think the AI narrative, the idea that there's going to be competing products, let's say, like I think a few months ago, there was rumors about a ChatGPT pin that you would have that would draw context about your everyday life and then replace your phone, iPhone potentially. I think some of those fears have been, people are not as worried about that to some extent. Mm-hmm. That the idea that people are going to be replacing their phones with an AI-powered replacement product.
And what's your take on AI glasses? Of course, we saw Meta come out with an updated version of its Ray-Ban AI glasses. Not sure exactly what they do. Apple, of course, tried with the Vision Pro, these clunky-looking goggles that pretty much came out to rave reviews, but the price point was too expensive. We assume that Apple will come out with more similar type of glasses, that similar to what Meta is doing. Is this what's going to replace an iPhone, in your opinion, or it's just a more gimmicky type product?
So I would answer this question a little bit. I would frame this a little bit differently, which is that I think the idea, I think what we look at when you look at these kinds of technological shifts is to really study the kind of the motivation behind the product that is being made. So I think when you look at Meta's glasses, beyond whether how cool they are when you put them on, I think that the real motivation for Meta to make these glasses is to own a platform. Mm-hmm. Because historically, if you go through Facebook's corporate history, they have suffered, for lack of a better word, in not being able to own the device that provides the services that they have. So
everybody's held captive to Apple
and Google to some extent. Mm-hmm. So one example, in 2021, Apple changed the privacy practices that apps on the iPhone are able to access. And that really hurt Facebook's ability to target ads. Mm-hmm. And the stock price fell by quite a bit, partly in response to these changes by Apple. And so Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg have always been very motivated to try and go out and build a platform so that they can control their own destiny. I don't really have a strong view as to whether glasses are going to be the next computing platform. I think people who have tried them said they're pretty awesome. Mm-hmm. But from the way I look at it is that I think if they do happen to be successful, Apple will most likely still be the platform that people use because they have the ecosystem. They have people are familiar with the iOS ecosystem. They have the products that they can connect to the glasses. They have the distribution through the Apple Store and Apple Care servicing network so that people's glasses will actually work. And so I think they're really well positioned and they have the brand. Mm-hmm. So people trust Apple hardware.
100%. People are a little iffy on Meta,
yes.
Right? Yeah.
So I think if you put all those things together, I think it's, I think I would bet on Apple being a big player in AI glasses to the extent that they become a big thing.
Very interesting. So I guess the point that we're talking about Apple obviously is to show our approach to owning great businesses. Apple's been in our portfolio, Ernest, since 2012. I remember researching this. This is before your time. I remember researching the stock and making the case to our investment committee at the time why we should buy it. At the time, of course, it was a much different company.
Yeah.
This was right when the iPhone came out. People were worried it's just another hardware company. People
right.
had seen the decimation of other hardware companies over time.
Palm. Like
Palm and Motorola. Yeah, who made Palm? Motorola?
Palm was a public company.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Motorola, Nokia, and BlackBerry.
Yeah.
And rightly so, we're skeptical. But here we are, I guess, now, 13, 14 years later, the iPhone is still going strong and nothing has really replaced it. And it still has a dominant market share in the more luxury category of phones. And so I can't tell you how many narratives we've lived through owning the stock over 13, 14 years.
The China one specifically.
Yeah.
It's been an issue. Like, people have been worried about China for Apple for every year that I've worked at Baskin Wealth
uh-huh.
Management.
Mm-hmm. People were always worried about a one-trick company. They're not innovating anymore. It's the same old product. I mean, I've heard that for a decade plus, yet here we are. The stock is obviously compounded for us at 20 times or more. And Apple, of course, what is it, approaching $400+ billion in revenue and generating $100 billion of profit and free cash flow. And you can imagine that there's lots more products and services it will sell to its customers going forward. There's so many big markets that Apple can get into, whether it's healthcare, financial services, you name it, there's big opportunities. Robotics, home automation, unbelievable stuff. And as if it's a trusted brand, we're pretty excited to own Apple. Hopefully, I can guarantee you one thing, there'll be more scary narratives holding Apple for the next 10 years. But if the fundamentals are up and to the right, and we can see a tremendous growth going forward, and Apple's able to reinvest at high rates, we'll continue to stick with the company. So we had some good earnings from a number of our companies. Not everyone reacts. We've talked about this so many times. We don't stress about day-to-day movements. So we're
even week-to-week.
Week-to-week, yeah. So Netflix reported earnings, for example, yesterday, I think, what's today, October 23rd,
22nd?
22nd. So Netflix reported yesterday. There was a lot of noise in those numbers. But excluding the noise, 17% revenue growth. It would have beaten earnings expectations. It raised its guidance. It raised its free cash flow per share expectation guidance going forward. And, you know, the company is so excited about all the programming, that slate that is coming out. And as the company gets bigger, it has the ability to bid on more sporting events or more, make more video games and continue to grow the flywheel. Will it have the same type of growth that it's had the past few years? Maybe not, or maybe it'll be better, hard to know. So did you learn anything new from Netflix? Obviously, we learned that the stock is 10% cheaper, even though the results were very, very good in our opinion. Maybe, I guess it just wasn't enough.
Yeah, so I think before we talk about Netflix, I think the reason that we don't pay a lot of attention to quarterly earnings moves, and I think too many investors often see Netflix stock down 10%, right? And then their immediate reaction is, well, something must be wrong with the company, right?
Yeah.
But I think that there is so much... The reason that we don't focus specifically on the price movements on this earnings day is because of how stocks generally trade and the types of trading that occurs for these companies. So I want to give an example. So let's say a company gave guidance in their first quarter earnings. They said they're going to do $10 per share.
Okay.
The market was originally expecting them to do $8 per share. And so they raised the guidance. Everyone's happy. Stock goes up.
Mm-hmm.
And after the earnings, there might be, there's a lot of traders out there.
Yes.
What they do is they try to predict whether Netflix is going to, how Netflix is going to do throughout the quarter. In the next earnings day, are they going to raise guidance? Are they going to lower guidance? And so the stock might drift upwards to reflect that new guidance. And leading up to the earnings date, there might be some whispers that the company is going to beat earnings and they're going to raise their earnings targets beyond what was originally raised.
Mm-hmm. So the stock starts to climb on no news.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so on the earnings day, if the company doesn't raise to the extent that people expect them to raise, then the stock will fall.
Yeah.
Right. But then if you look at the price movement from Q1 to Q2, the stock still might have gone up to reflect the increased guidance.
Correct.
So what this, all of what all of this says is that you have to look, you can't just look at one day price movements to decide whether the company is doing well or not, because there's so much trading and so much noise that it's not really reflective of what's happening.
Yeah, or make a statement like it's overvalued. It was overvalued. Right. It was so easy to see.
Right.
That's why now the stock is down.
Right. Mm. And so there's all these kinds of factors. And so for Netflix, I think the stock's still up 30% year to date.
Yeah, it started the year about $890 a share. It's over $1,100 a share today.
So it's I think you're pretty sad if you bought it yesterday.
Yes.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that there's something fundamentally wrong with the business.
No.
Right. And so I thought within the earnings, there was a bit of a Brazilian tax issue that they had.
Yeah, which wasn't disclosed to investors until...
It was disclosed.
Until the day of earnings,
exactly,
right? It wasn't something that, hey guys, we're going to have this tax issue. They just announced it on earnings day, and that was a surprise. Although I think the market looks past one-time events. So I don't think that's the rationale for the stock being down.
Yeah, I think every metric that they're reporting, so I think engagement was up, revenues are growing. They don't disclose users anymore, but I would guess users are up pretty nicely as well. Mm-hmm. And
have they raised prices recently?
No, not lately.
Okay.
Maybe in certain markets they have. But I think that there was nothing in there that really concerned me from a fundamentals perspective.
Mm-hmm.
The big hype this quarter was obviously K-pop Demon Hunters. I don't know if your kids are still in that age.
Well, my kids are 18 and 21, and I don't think they watch that, but they might.
Right.
I have no idea. It was a huge hit, right? Hundreds of millions.
It was the most watched movie on Netflix ever.
Yeah. Cartoon, right?
It's
about
a cartoon.
A girl band who are also demon hunters.
Yeah, my daughter and all her friends are crazy about that show right now. Mm-hmm, keep singing her song. Keep singing the songs.
Yeah.
And I think it's just another example of Netflix being able to turn, you know, kind of weird, obscure IP into mega hits.
Yes.
Because I feel very confident in saying that K-pop Demon Hunters, if it was an HBO show or an Amazon show or a Disney show, would not be the same cultural phenomenon that it was on Netflix.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
So I think they continue to broaden the types of content that they're offering. So they're doing a little bit more sports.
How is the wrestling going? Because they spent a lot of money securing the TV rights for WWE wrestling.
Yep. And so their strategy with sports, and they've been pretty consistent about this, is that they want to focus on big tentpole type events. So the wrestling events, for instance, they have NFL games on Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
These are events that cater to, you know, casual viewers who might want to watch a very specific game.
They've having boxing and tennis competitions, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They have the baseball event in Japan.
Okay.
So these are very large events that even casual viewers may want to tune into. And they don't disclose the metrics for these things. But what they say is that they generally lead to people, more people signing up for Netflix. And once they're on Netflix, they would watch other stuff. So,
but Netflix is competing against some very big boys like Amazon and Apple. I saw Apple announce that it secured some Formula One rights. So maybe you know, Netflix was bidding on that. Hard to know. On the plus side, of course, Netflix doesn't have the issues that legacy cable companies have. Just declining subscribers, still have to invest in bought in CapEx, you know, and so those companies, the Warner Brothers, the Paramounts, the CBSs, the Viacoms of the world are not doing great. And you know, if they want to sell their content, they have to run their own streamers. And it, are anybody making money on streaming aside from Netflix?
No, they're well, yeah. It's hard to know exactly, partly because things like Prime Video are bundled into the Prime subscription.
For sure.
But I think with the F1 example in particular, it's interesting because Netflix was the one who is almost single-handedly responsible for F1's popularity as a sport because of the F1 Drive to Survive documentary, where people watched it. They thought, this is incredible. And then they wanted to watch the actual F1 races. Mm-hmm. And so that led to Apple eventually paying a much higher price for the rights to F1 from the value that Netflix created. And so...
And Apple was involved with... They made a movie with Brad Pitt, right? Yeah. Or financed a movie, I think, about Formula One.
Yeah.
So they tried to tie that together.
And so... Mm-hmm. And this is part of the thing that is part of our thesis about Netflix is that because they're able to create so much of these cultural phenomenon, they're able to monetize this in some form or another. So K-pop Demon Hunters, they announced an exclusive deal with Hasbro to make the toys for them, right? And so slowly trying to make more of money beyond just the subscription.
Fascinating. Fees. And of course, we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about AI impact on Netflix. You know, there's talk, of course, on the positive side that AI will make making movies and shows easier, right? And maybe even cheaper. So there, and of course, there could be a proliferation of new content and new shows as a result of people using AI. So is there any, I mean, to me, it seems like it's a positive tailwind for Netflix. Anything you see on the negative side, AI's impact on Netflix? Are we all just going to be watching made up AI movies and videos going forward, or do we really crave the human made product?
So I think that's been a bit of a worry for Netflix in particular, is there a point in the future where you can just type a prompt on ChatGPT and it can spin up a 2-hour long movie for you to watch, right?
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, I think most reasonable observers would say that we're probably not going to get there anytime soon.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think there are starting to be AI actresses now, apparently.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've read the article about that one.
Yeah.
Where I think the union's not very happy about
no,
that.
No, and I think the union did sign agreements, North American Film Union, about using AI actors and AI writers and trying to block that. So, But
from Netflix's perspective, I think they are using AI to, I think they use it in some of their movies to make you look young, like some of the actresses for younger scenes. They use it for recommendations.
We should use that for this podcast. Yeah.
Well, I don't think we're old yet.
I'm a year younger. Yeah.
Okay. But they are using them for subtitles. So I think they're just using it in subtle ways to improve the service.
Yeah.
And I think that I don't really view these as transformational one way or another to Netflix.
And obviously, the big transformational thing for Netflix was changing to an ad subscriber model for its business. How's that going? And is that something that, you know, was a smart decision looking back now, a number of years later?
I think it was absolutely the right decision, especially because it creates a lower price point that if you are, you know, for whatever reason, if you'd rather only pay $7 a month for Netflix, then you have that option to pay for Netflix with ads.
Mm-hmm.
While from Netflix's perspective, I think they make a little bit less for the ad-supported tier today, but it allows them to, you know, extend the reach into a lower income type of, or a consumer that's less likely to want to pay.
Or a consumer who was essentially stealing the
right. I think, I think that's the other point too, is that, you know, like there's a lot of people out there that just pirate their shows.
Not naming names, but yes.
Yeah, there's a lot of, you can go to, you know, some stores and buy a top box.
Yeah.
And you can plug it in and you can watch all these shows. But
that's illegal, by the way. Don't do it.
Yes, it is. But I'm
certainly not recommending that. Yeah.
But now that you can just pay $7 a month, I think it's $7.
Whatever it is.
And which is basically the price of a cup of coffee at Starbucks now, right? And having access to, you know, their full catalog, being able to watch their live events, especially, I think that certainly helps as well.
I mean, I can tell you at my house, we've reduced the amount of money we're spending on cable. We still obviously are huge sports fanatics, and with those Blue Jays in the World Series, we need access to that. But I can imagine a day where the streamers are going to own all the sports rights. It's inevitable, don't you think?
Yeah, I think that that's a totally separate topic here. Yeah. But I think that it's a big issue for the sports leagues, especially as they figure out how to make money in a streaming world versus the old model where, you know, you pay money for your cable bundle and then you get to watch the sports.
Yeah, but here's a company that has 200 plus million subscribers ready for you to get access to your content. And I can't imagine any other device or service like Netflix that has that much reach going forward. So we're sticking with Netflix. The stock has done well year to date. The stock has done very well since we've owned it. We'll talk a little bit in a feature discussion about compounding and maybe use an example about Netflix. Two other companies that reported earnings recently, Taiwan Semiconductor. Check out our podcast we did on Taiwan Semi, a recent purchase. Very pleased with the results of that company. I mean, the results were stunning in the sense of it also raised guidance, strong gross margins, demand, it says, for AI chips is insane. I think those were the words.
Specific word.
Yeah. So, this is something everybody already knows, right? It's not, we all know that the spending is going crazy. So Taiwan Semiconductor, I think we bought it at a very, very reasonable valuation. Worries about China, about at the time overbuilding and are there going to be any results from AI? Now I think there's less worries about that, but anything could always pop up. With Taiwan Semiconductor, you know, Ernest, is the thesis still alive and is it still attractive to you, given that there's been a big run-up in the last few months on those type of names, the Taiwan Semis, the NVIDIAs, the Broadcoms?
So I think for Taiwan Semiconductor specifically, it's whenever there's a big trend like AI, I think it's very useful to follow companies like Taiwan Semiconductor, which are the kind of the underlying service providers that enable whatever trend you have. Because you can listen to Elon Musk and you can listen to Sam Altman and talk about how AI is curing cancer and, you know, solving all these PhD level math problems. And all that stuff is like nice and exciting.
But very exciting.
They're very, those people are highly incentivized to portray AI in the most favorable light, mm-hmm. right? They're not going to tell you that AI is not working well and that nobody's actually using it, right? Mm-hmm. But when you look at a company like Taiwan Semiconductor, they have to spend a lot of money building up these fabs, these chip factories. And so they need to be able to predict what the actual demand for AI-related chips are going to be. Right, they have to be much more realistic about the prospects of AI, because if they build too many fabs, if AI turns out not to be as big of a thing as people hope, then they're going to lose a lot of money.
Yeah,
right. And so from TSMC's perspective, they said they did a lot of research. They talked to not just their customers, which is NVIDIA, but also their customers' customers. So they hinted at Google, Meta, and all Apple mm-hmm. and all these other companies mm-hmm. to try and gauge the true level of demand for AI-related chips, and especially for inferencing going forward.
And explain inferencing for those that don't know what that means.
Yeah, so what inferencing is very big picture, there's training workloads, which is kind of teaching how the AI model how to recognize patterns. Mm-hmm. And then you have the inferencing, which is when you actually use the product. So when you use ChatGPT and you type in like, what's the, you know, give me the stats for last night's baseball game, that is an inferencing request. It's because it sends the data, your request to the AI model, where it will, you know, run through kind of what it should respond and then send the response back to you. Mm-hmm. And so long story short, TSMC said they've done a lot of research into this. They see no shortage in demand for AI-related chips going forward.
And what uses more compute power? Is it the training or the inference?
Well, this becomes really complicated because now you have things like reasoning models, where if you search, like if you can ask Gemini and ChatGPT to think about a problem and solve for you, and it actually shows up in real time. And then there's like image generating, which uses a different amount of tokens, and video generation, which is, again, is very resource intensive.
And explain tokens for those that don't understand what we're talking about.
Yeah, token is basically the currency that you use for computing power for AI generation.
Got it.
A more complex type of query. So if you wanted to do research on, you know, Queen Elizabeth II and write a 10-page essay on it.
My son wants to write an essay for university.
Yeah, that is going to consume more AI computing power or tokens versus if I write, give me a recipe for cupcakes.
Yeah.
Right? So...
And we've legitimately seen the demand for tokens go parabolic.
Yes, and that's exactly what TSMC says.
Yeah.
They see no shortage, no reason to think that demand is going to slow down anytime
soon.
Why
would it? Why are there so many skeptics? I get when there's new technology, people will always say it's going to be a bubble. It's not transformational. There's no value to it. But here we're clearly seeing the demand explode, and how can demand and interest for knowledge and information not grow from here?
And then OpenAI is saying they're going to start go into adult type content.
Yeah. I mean, that sex sells. We know that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, like, back to the earlier point mm-hmm. is that I think TSMC, basically what TSMC is saying is that demand is very strong. They're going to have to build more fabs.
What is their visibility into demand? Is it 1 year? Is it 3 years? Is it five years?
They said that right now, like the conversations that they're having are for 2 years out.
Okay.
Yeah. So they know what the demand is going to be, mm-hmm. right? Because all these companies are putting in their orders for chips 2 years down the road. Mm-hmm. And so they think things are good.
Very good.
Which is very encouraging if you are bullish on the AI space as a whole.
For sure. And at the moment, Taiwan Semi is trading around 25 times forward earnings. It also has a huge whack of cash on its balance sheet. I think $60 billion net in cash, right? No debts.
Yep.
Yeah. And so, and that should compound going forward. Obviously, they're going to use some of that cash to build more factories, more fabs.
And more relevant especially relevant for TSMC is that as we go into the next generation of chips, they think that margins are going to go up.
Very interesting.
So they're going to make more money.
So it's an all good news story there. So another good news story, of course, is Waste Connections, a company that this year has kind of been flattish. It's been in our portfolio, Ernest, since about 2002, 2003. This is in a prior name and a prior form, but we've held it exclusively for that long a period of time. one of the best run industrial companies that we've ever found. Yep. Still the founder, still is came back to the business recently running it. The results have been strong. No question the valuation is at the higher level. And maybe that's what's holding the stock back recently. But, there was some worries that with falling recycling prices, with falling oil and gas prices, with trade and tariffs, that maybe Waste Connections wouldn't report strong results. But the opposite happened. They reported very strong results, raised the dividend 11%. And said no change to the guidance going forward and making tons of acquisitions. So any interesting insights you've learned from Waste Connections this quarter?
Yeah, I think earlier in the year, there were some issues that they had with one of the landfills in geography is not coming to my mind right now, but basically they had some environmental issues.
California?
I think it was California. Yeah. They had some problems there and they had to shut the landfill down. But I think the most interesting thing, basically what they said was that 2026 is going to be a good year.
Yeah.
There's going to be good price increases. There's going to be margin expansion. You know, demand for garbage collection is pretty stable. And I think something that was interesting was that they're starting to use AI in their business to do things like budgeting, route optimizations, these kinds of mundane things, which they think are going to benefit margins.
Awesome. Right? Awesome.
Which is, as a side note, I think this is good news for Constellation Software. Mm-hmm. Because we're seeing an example where an industrial company is using their existing software vendors to generate productivity from, their business. Mm-hmm. And so I think that Constellation Software is, I don't know if Waste Connections uses Constellation Software.
No, but they start, Constellation is, has 1,000 different software.
But this is exactly, I think, what you would expect to see from Constellation Software's end markets going forward, is that they're going to be rolling out these AI solutions and they're going to be the ones, the customers are going to be benefiting from it and sticking with their existing vendors.
Yeah. We own a business, Ernest, and we use a number of software providers, and we're hoping that our software providers will be able to offer AI tasks.
Yep.
We're already using some of them, and hopefully more to, as you said, make our employees more productive, reduce time spent on mundane tasks, which are not exciting for anybody. Yep. And those employees can work on higher level, higher quality transactions, higher level, things to help grow our business instead of doing data entry or wasting time.
Right.
So our feature discussion today is going to be about why we're sticking with compounders.
Yeah.
and talk a little bit about what compounding means to us. So compounding is reinvesting your cash flows, right?
Yep.
Everybody can understand what a compounding means. You put your money in the bank, you put $100, you earn 4% interest. At the end of the year, you have $104. You buy another 4% interest, and then at the end of the year, you have $107, $108, whatever it is. And it keeps growing and it keeps growing and keeps growing. And then over 40 or 50 years, you've compounded your money. When we talk about compounding for companies, it's no different. It's companies using the cash flow that they earn to reinvest in either growing their business, building new services, making acquisitions, buying back stock, those type of things that will hopefully add value. And over time, compounding will lead to higher earnings per share growth, hopefully higher free cash flow per share, obviously lead to, if the company does well, higher stock price.
Yeah, I think that the way we think about compounding here is a little bit more narrow than just a great business.
Yeah,
because the distinction really is around companies that focus on capital allocation, right? In terms of how they are investing their money to make the most money possible. And that differs from a normal company, such as Apple or Nike or Spotify, where the primary management focus, like the primary job of the CEO, is trying to figure out how to, you know, make shoes and sell them better, right? Mm-hmm. And those are great businesses as well, but we're talking about companies like Berkshire Hathaway, where Warren Buffett is not trying personally to sell more See's candies or sell more insurance. He's thinking about, how do I invest the money that Berkshire Hathaway is making from his businesses to make more money? And so...
And his options, and he's got a lot of options with it. So the money comes in, just like getting paid, the money comes into your bank account after you've covered all your expenses, your home, your heating, your taxes, blah, blah, blah. You've got leftover money. You can leave it in the bank. You can try and time the stock market. You can loan it out. You can make an investment. There's lots of things that you can do with your money. Obviously, what the best capital allocators are trying to do is to reinvest that money at high rates.
Yep.
And invest it and think long term.
Yep. Yeah. And I think the reason that we like compounders is a couple of reasons. First of all, these are often people that are the most knowledgeable in their industry. So if you think about Alain Bédard at TFI, he's a really, really good trucker. He really understands the trucking industry. Think about Alain Bouchard at Alimentation Couche-Tard, mm-hmm. right? He's a convenience store industry expert. He's one of the best people in the world in understanding convenience stores. And so they're able to go out and invest in convenience stores or in trucking or whatever at a better rate of return than what we as investors can find in the public markets on a regular company in the stock exchange, right? And so, and this is also more tax efficient because they're not paying the cash out as a dividend, and it's not getting taxed when we, you know, mm-hmm. we receive the dividends. Mm-hmm. So over the long run, these companies do a terrific job of that. They make money, they run their businesses well, they grow their businesses by making acquisitions or doing share buybacks, and the stock price generally follows.
Mm-hmm. But more than that, they have to think about, is now a good time to make an acquisition? Yep. Is now a good time to spend money to build our convenience stores like Couche-Tard, or should we buy competitors?
Yep.
Times are tough right now, but our stock price has fallen. Maybe we should, it's more attractive to buy back our stock. Right, because buying a competitor will be more expensive and our business is humming perfectly. So these are the things that smart CEOs have to think about when it comes to capital allocation. We really hate when companies have an automatic share buyback program, right, where there's no thought process to it. We have all this cash coming in, we're just going to buy back our stock no matter what the price is.
Yeah,
we don't want that.
Yeah.
We want a company that thinks about, well, it's not a good time to buy back our stock. It's a good time to reinvest in our business now. It's a good, because all our competitors are doing lousy. Constellation Software, we talked about it on the last episode about the share buyback, why they're not doing it. And you said it perfectly, right? Our stock is trading at 3-4% free cash flow yield. We can reinvest the cash flow that we get at and earn at least 20%.
Yep.
Why in that world would we want to earn 3% when we can earn 20%? And that stuff adds up over the long term.
Right. And I think what we like to see in compounders is that they usually have very unique corporate structures in the way that the business is set up. Mm-hmm. They're usually very decentralized in terms of how they run in order, you know, to make acquisitions and make them work without you personally having to go down and fix things. And there's a lot of thought that's put into the incentive programs to ensure that everybody's on the same page. And so this year has been a little bit rough for, I think, a lot of quote unquote traditional compounders.
Yeah.
The stock price hasn't been going up.
We have lots of names, Ferrari, Copart, Adobe, Amazon, even Apple. This year it's up, but it's up a little bit. I mean, it's been a wonderful year for more speculative investments. And that's what you would expect in a bull market where interest rates are coming down and where people are very excited about new technologies, why in the world do I need to buy more Berkshire Hathaway when I can invest in this AI thing, or I can buy some type of cryptocurrency, right? And so it's just less attractive. And of course, to on the opposite side, some of those compounders have done very, very well over the long term. And maybe there was some crowding into those some of those names. And maybe the case is, well, they're still good businesses, but maybe some valuations of other stocks are now more attractive in different sectors. So you can't learn very much from a short-term performance.
I think it's hard to generalize broadly across, you know, compounders and companies that make a lot of acquisitions, because companies are obviously, you know, facing their own circumstances in their respective end markets. Like Constellation Software lost their CEO, for instance, right? But I think one of the challenges facing this group as a whole is that following 2021 and 2022, seller expectations for smaller businesses have become very, very high. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, CCL Industries. It's a company that we own.
And let's break that down. I've read that there's more private equity companies than there are publicly traded stocks.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of cash that's being used to buy and roll up private companies.
Yeah.
And these private equities are paying higher prices. Yeah. And may not have the discipline that a Constellation Software has, or a First Service has, or a CCL has.
Yes.
Within its own industry. And so they respect you as a shareholder, and they're not going to pay up for these companies, and wait obviously for things to cool down before they swoop in. And we're starting to see some of that.
Right. And I think that's been one of the challenges for a lot of these compounders, is that because they are very disciplined in terms of the types of returns that they want from acquisitions, the prices are just simply too high in many cases. They've come down a little bit, but they're still too high. They're not able to meet their hurdle or target returns that they want from acquisitions. And so they're just sitting on cash, the balance sheet in Berkshire Hathaway's case. Like, they're just accumulating cash every quarter.
And this is not to knock private equity, but incentives matter, right?
Yeah.
Private equity's goal is to put the money that they get in these funds to work,
yeah,
right? And if they dilly-dally, they don't get paid. And of course, they charge, and they also charge huge performance fees if they do well. So there's every incentive for them to sometimes even overpay.
Yes.
And not have the same type of discipline as a publicly traded company.
Especially because they use a lot of leverage in their structure for the deals. So I think what we do as investors when we look at compounders is what we really try to think about is, you know, is the runway for acquisitions still as attractive as it used to be? And are they as disciplined are they losing their discipline in terms of the price that they're paying? Because there's a lot of fake compounders out there as well, mm-hmm. where they make acquisitions, they tell a compoundery story about decentralization, but they don't really, there's no integration playbook. There's no secret sauce there. They're just arbitraging the difference between public and private market values.
Well, that's going to come back to bite you in the butt when you overpay for acquisitions, or there's no synergies, or it's your incentives are all skewed, right?
Yeah.
So these are things that, as long-term investors, we have to think about: the incentives, the compensation, how management is rewarded. Obviously, if they're rewarded on just getting bigger, that is not necessarily a good thing, right? So you have to think about how all these things come into play. I mean, when you talked about TFI, not only are they good operators, but lots of acquisitions that it can make can help the overall complex.
Yes.
Right? Whether it's more buying power, better relationships with customers. Well, now we bought this company and now we have more of your geography with a certain customer, right? So there's just some interesting things that can happen as these companies use their free cash flow versus private equity.
Yeah, I think that this time will pass. Yeah. I think that our experience has told us that these are really, really smart people who will find ways to do smart things with their business. Mm-hmm. And I think that I feel confident that the compounders that we own are going to be fine.
And I'll go back to the Apple example at the beginning. The narrative at the time, Apple's not innovating, Apple's not losing in China, it's a no-growth business. I mean, these lulls in activity, in excitement, and growth can halt for a period of time.
Right.
But that can also create unprecedented demand in the future when the companies do get it right, or when the business cycle changes or what have you, right? And I think that's what Apple's experiencing now, and that's why the recovery in the stock price. So, Ernest, how do we know when to say goodbye to a compounder? Just, get rid of it in the portfolio, because as long-term investors, it's very hard to know the future. And if a company has a great track record of delivering strong results and reinvesting at high rates, and then it hits some kind of road bump, for whatever reason, or the stock falls for whatever reason, how do you decide to, I'm going to stick it out?
So I think there's two things that I pay a lot of attention to. The first is, are they still disciplined with their valuations? Because there have been a lot of, there are a lot of companies that make a lot of acquisitions where over time, they've maybe because of the pricing environment out there, they're lowering the returns that they're looking for in mm-hmm. acquisitions. And I think that's a bad sign, because then you're just, you're losing your discipline for the types of deals that you're looking for. So that's something that I pay a lot of attention to, as opposed to, how many deals they're making in any given period of mm-hmm. time. And I think the other thing that is important is the operational discipline at the firms that they're acquiring. Like, are problems popping up at some of these acquisitions that they're making, right? Which may suggest that they're not as diligent as they used to be in terms of making these deals.
So it's a combination of looking at the qualitative and the quantitative.
Right.
And being patient, of course. I've said this before, we have many companies in our portfolio that have more than doubled. We've held many companies for a very long period of time. Every single one of those companies has gone through a temporary or even a longer problem or issue or worry. It may have been smart for us to get rid of it. Sometimes it may have been smart for us to do nothing. But, we're not going to let the stock price dictate what we're going to do. We're going to let the fundamentals, we're going to let, the actions that the management is taking, and just getting a sense of, is there any chance for things to get better, or should we cut and run?
And public market investors can get impatient.
Yes.
Right? Like, let's say that there's a company that used to do X amount of acquisitions every year, and then this year they're doing half of that, and then the cash is starting to accumulate, and people are starting to wonder, is the acquisition story over?
I'm thinking when you say that, I'm thinking of TransDigm, for example. That immediately pops up into our mind.
Right.
This is one of the most successful reinvestment of cash flow stories that ever existed.
Yeah.
And just recently, the stock price is kind of flatlined because they haven't been as aggressive making acquisitions.
Right. Yeah. So I think you just have to be patient. As long as you trust the management.
And in the meantime, of course, you don't want to make acquisitions to be the focal point. You also have to have a good operations of your existing businesses,
right?
A good thesis, right? TransDigm, I think, is going to do well long-term. More people will be flying. The planes continue to get older. I mean, these are a good thesis going forward, and they're great operators of the businesses that they have. So if there's a lull in acquisition activity or there's a lull in demand in the short term, you can have confidence that the long-term thesis is still intact if you believe in the operations and the product and the service that the company is involved in.
Right.
All right. So great conversation. Thank you so much for joining us today, and we'll see you back here real soon.
This podcast is for informational purposes only, and any forecasts on the economy, markets, or individual securities should not be viewed as investment advice, a recommendation or an offer or solicitation to buy or sell any securities. Clients of Baskin Wealth Management and the speakers on this podcast may own shares of the companies discussed. Information on this podcast is current as of the time of production and is subject to change. If you have any questions or would like to subscribe to these podcasts, visit our website at baskinwealth.com.